you've got credits at the end, title sequences at the end of films, which, you know, I feel like, you know, you've just sat through a conversation with this story. At the end of a conversation, you just go, all right, bye. And then you leave.
Wait,
you
know? We're not meant to do that.
Yeah. Imagine being in a cinema and then suddenly the lights, you know, just cuts off, lights on, all right, bye. It's not like that. And so title sequences and credits for me is a kind of a way of films and stories that you've kind of been investing your time with as a way of saying, you know, this is the end of the conversation.
It allows you to process it. That's amazing.
Welcome to Filmmaking Frame, the show that interviews industry professionals to find out the tips and tricks to make it behind the silver screen. With me, as always, is my co-host,
Tom Dexter,
and myself, Danian Hughes.
Today with us is award-winning motion graphics and title designer, Santi Boddington. Santi started her career working on the graphics for trailers such as Peter Lou and Jojo Rabbit, and then went on to design the title sequences for Netflix's Inventing Anna. She now works as a freelancer. Hello, Santi.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So we always like to start this podcast by asking our guests to tell us a bit about what is your role and how does it fit into the general film industry ecosystem?
So I would say my role falls into post-production, sometimes more graphics than VFX. And what I mean by that is the graphics and the motion graphics that I do in post-production can work with VFX. So if you've got a phone, for example, any of the graphics that you see appearing on that phone, animating, or even text messages that appear next to the person, that's what I would design and animate. If it appears on the phone, I would design and animate that and then supply that element to VFX that then applies it or composites onto the phone to make it look realistic. And it makes it feel at one in the place that it's supposed to be.
Awesome.
So there's a beautiful shot that was done in camera, then there's a beautiful bit of graphics and it merges it together so it's one shot and it looks seamless.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Exactly. So you can have like reflections on it that VFX would apply, blurring, just anything that would create a more realistic look. So that's one side of the things I do. And then the other part is I do title sequences, end credits, opening credits, rollers that you get at the end of films. I design and animate a lot of that as well. Yeah.
I think since Game of Thrones, and probably before The Wire and various ones, it became a big thing to have title sequences on the front end. This is probably a question I should have saved for later in the podcast, but what is the proportion of projects out there that are having big title sequences versus sort of simpler?
I think the TV realm certainly recently has had big focus on title sequences. You know, you've got Netflix's Stranger Things, Game of Thrones, which is a good reference. Those are like big budgeted title sequences. But then you can get smaller title sequences that are just as effective, like Breaking Bad. You know, that was a very short, simplistic, but beautifully done. And that you get everything that you needed to know from it from like 10 seconds.
Yeah, that was really efficiently done.
Yeah.
And I know from when we've spoken in the past that you told me that Stranger Things even uses their title sequence in the marketing.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what's the beauty of the work that you can do as a title designer is that you can see it transform from the screen into everyday, you know, relation to the film or TV show. Game of Thrones, for example, is one of them as well. But Stranger Things, you know, you see it not just on like t-shirts and marketing and it's just like the show's brand logo, but then you can get what's really fascinating about Stranger Things as well is that you get all the pop culture references. So you get a lot of people making the Stranger Things look, but with like different text or different words and things, which is the same for Mad Men as well, all the Simpsons as well. Like you see that as like pop culture and it becomes more than just the title sequence logo that you see on screen, but it can come out and into everything else.
The design for that originate with the title designer, or can it come from various places? Like, is that, if you were a title designer, you can say that I designed that look as well as the actual animation.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like, you've got Star Wars, for example, that was designed and animated by a title designer. And then that's become the show's, the franchise's logo from the beginning.
That's a brilliant example.
And the iconic scroll as well that you get, you know, in a galaxy far, far away, you know, that endless scroll. And apparently they did it on a whim and they hated it and they thought it was going to be terrible. And they didn't expect it to have the reaction that it did and that it became the staple of the whole franchise is just that piece of design.
You must wish you were in the rooms of some of these designers when they created those iconic designs.
I think it would be fascinating, especially Saul Bass, which was an iconic title designer of his time.
And he worked on things like Hitchcock and...
Yeah, exactly. And then still to this day, you get a lot of references to his motion design work that you see in like Catch Me If You Can, the title sequences that they did for Catch Me If You Can. You can see it's like a direct reference. But even Taylor Swift's music video or like lyric video that she did was almost a direct reference to his work as well.
Wow.
I think it was for Look What You Made Me Do, one of the music, like lyrical video that she released a couple of years ago. Because as somebody who recognizes that style, I was like, oh, that's definitely like inspired by Saul Bass. Yeah. But I just thought it was fascinating that it was like in the music world, especially for like Taylor Swift.
Yeah. Who's grossed so much money with her irresistible. It's amazing.
I felt like you kept looking at me. I know. But
I was looking at you to be like amused of like, I feel like neither of us are...
Oh, Swifties.
Yeah.
Although I do actually really like her music. I just I don't follow it, so I can't name things. Mm-hmm. Amazing. So we also, it'd be really fascinating to know at what point in your early years or into your teens, your early 20s, whatever it is, that you decided you wanted to be a title designer or was it just design? What was your route?
I think in terms of title design, it was when I was in the cinema and I can't remember what age I was, but we had gone to the cinema to see A Series of Unfortunate Events by Lemony Snicket. And
the original one.
The original, not the Netflix. Not the Netflix. Yeah. So this was going to the cinema to see that. And they had an end title sequence. And I was just in complete awe by this title sequence. And it left such an impression on me that I remember leaving that cinema and thinking that was somebody's job was to make that. I want to do that. I want to make that. So since then, it kind of became my vocation to be able to go out and pursue that. And I had an artistic background. You know, I did fine art at school and I did a little bit of stop motion animation. So I was interested in animation. But I didn't really know how to get into the film industry. I wasn't exposed to any of that growing up. None of my family are in the industry. No one in my immediate family were in the creative industry like that in any way. So when I was looking at courses at universities, I didn't really know what I was looking for. I just knew I wanted to do something with art. And I came across a course in Glasgow, which was for communication design. And this open day that I went to, because I went to lots of different Scottish universities on open days, they advertised this course, which really appealed to me. And I thought, that's pretty much what I want to be doing, because it focuses on like broad aspect, does illustration, design, branding, typography, animation, like loads of different aspects of design. So I thought, that's what I want to do. Went and did the course, got accepted into Aberdeen. And one of the projects that we were tasked to do was, I think in my second year or third year, was to create a title sequence animated based on a book that had been made into a TV series or a film yet. And so I had found this really good website at the time, which is still really good resource now, called Art of the Title. So it's got a huge library of amazing title sequences and studios that create title sequences as credits. And I used that as a reference to create my own first ever title sequence. And I knew from before at the cinema that's what I wanted to do. So I was able to then use that project as like a way to pursue that. So once I graduated from university with a first, I was then stuck again, not knowing how to get into the industry. You know, I've got a degree in design and animation, but no kind of idea of how to actually get into that part of design. And I did an animation course, and it was while I was in this animation course that a friend of mine, she wanted to do documentary and filmmaking and camera work. Lizzie Owen, who you should have on this podcast as well as a future guest.
We'll invite her, yeah.
Yeah. And she forwarded me from the National Film and Television School a new course that they were starting that year, focusing on motion graphics in the film and TV industry. So doing title sequences, doing graphic design on, you know, in film. And she was like, this has got your name on it, like
almost,
all over
yeah,
it.
Yeah, sounds like they almost designed the course
for me.
You.
Yes, it really was. And I remember getting it and I was just thinking, oh my God, this is it. Like, I have to do this. And it was a diploma course. It was 1 year and I had already graduated. So I finished my 3 months animation course that I was doing, which was actually in Canada. So I remember flying from Canada to London, to Aberdeen, where I lived at the time, getting on a plane the next day, jet lagged, to fly from Aberdeen to London, London to Beaconsfield on a bus, and then had my interview. And they essentially offered me a place at the end of the interview. And they just said, Hugo, who's the course, the head of the course, is just such a good tutor. He was amazing. And he said, well, you know, you've got a place if you want it. You know, he was happy with my portfolio and, you know, what I was interested in and everything. So I just remember messaging my parents on the way back to Heathrow to then get the plane back to Aberdeen, just saying, all right, so like a couple of weeks, I'm moving to London and to Beaconsfield. So I was really excited, but oh, I think I was so lucky because the jet lag, basically, I was wide awake for the few hours that that interview was. And then
you crashed.
And then I crashed. So yeah, that's how I got from being a student to going to university to having this course offered by the NFTS. And I know now that there are a couple of other courses that I think do similar things at other universities, but I don't think any offer it quite like the film school. And what I really, really valued the most about the film school was that you work directly with other students, working with them side by side. So you could be working with documentary, you could be working with TV, you could be working with the game students on their projects. And, you know, they're working with other students like composers or sound or editors that are all students learning and practically doing everything all practical. And I think that's what I took away the most from that course.
You're designing for actual films,
yes,
rather than the theoretical adaptation of a book.
Correct.
Which whereby you wouldn't have competing voices on the design and all of the human elements of collaborating when you're working in film.
Exactly. I think it was like the first exposure to real world working projects that I got. And because you were, you know, sheltered in a way through, you know, your course heads and everything, you get to make mistakes as well. So you can learn from that. And I think that was very, very valuable.
Yeah, so exciting. I wish I could do design and then go to the NFTS and do design now.
And so what was your first job coming out of the NFTS?
So what the NFTS does a lot of, like I did the same when I had my degree show at university, but the NFTS did something similar where they have like a exhibition slash showcase where they show the students' work and they invite industry professionals along or like friends of the school or people that would be involved in that area. And so from that, I met Harry, who worked at the time at a company called Empire Design that does trailers. And we got chatting and swapped contact details. And then a few days later, he emailed me and they said that they were looking for somebody to fill a junior position. And they wanted to invite me in for an interview because he had seen my work and he was really impressed. And, you know, I went up to him and I talked to him as well. So they invited me in. I showed them my portfolio and it became very apparent that they were more about talking about themselves as a company than it was them asking me questions.
But because that's good because that means they're selling themselves to you, yeah. So they can convince you to work there.
Yeah. And I'd never had any interviews before that, like professional interviews, other than like maybe one trial shift at like Boots or something when I was a student.
Did you get that job?
I did. Yes. Yeah. So they offered me a 2-week trial period, which I completed successfully. And then they moved me on to a full-time position, which, you know, obviously had the 3-month probation and everything, which I passed with flying colors. And so that was my first full-time job out of university. And I think from the time I graduated to getting a full-time job, I was very fortunate that, you know, I managed to do that within like a couple of weeks after graduating. So I was very, very lucky.
So you'd gone on this journey and now here you were an actual paid designer.
Yeah. Amazing. And I still don't know what I'm doing.
I have a
surprisingly common in our industry.
I have a quick question before we sort of delve into some of your professional career.
Uh-huh.
What would you say to past Xanthi now with your experience when she was either looking to go to NFTS or first going into Empire?
I think going into the NFTS, I feel like I did a lot of the right things, which was, you know, saying yes to everything, taking on as many projects as I could, you know, really milking as the experience while I was there as much as possible. But then it did stretch me too much. And I think that was the issue, was that I was always saying yes. You know, can you help us with this? Yes, of course. Can you, you know, get this by tomorrow? Yes, you know, I'll do it. Whereas I think that there's a very good learning experience by doing that. And my skills definitely took off and, you know, multiplied in a very fast way. But near the end of it, I was probably close to burning out because not only was I doing the course projects that they were assigning us, but also all the outside projects that I was taking on as like personal projects for like the video game courses and, you know, some of the documentary or like even other extra little projects that I was helping friends out or like other directors with their like, you know, shorts. So I think looking back, I would say it is okay to say no, or at least have like realistic expectations, because you go in there thinking that you can take on everything. So, yeah.
And if I may add, feeling like you have to take on everything.
Yes.
To make the most.
Well, that and that when you're still in the building stage of your career, that if you turn down any opportunity, someone will work, well, they'd never offer me one again. Or like, I'm only speaking from my own experience and also from people I've chatted, but seeing if that chimes with you.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very common when you're starting out, when you're so passionate about getting into the film and TV industry, to just take every opportunity. I would say counterpoint to what you're saying is, in a way, you learnt at the best time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the benefits of going into education is, and I know I had this when I was at the National Film Television School, was you do take on more than you necessarily do, but at least you've learnt that in a setting where you're all students.
Yes.
So yeah. If you were in the industry and you said yes to lots of projects as a freelancer especially, and then you can't deliver on them, that's person one, person two, person three aren't going to hire you again.
Yeah.
They might tell person four, five, and six not to hire you. And so then you're desperately trying to get person seven to... And there's a knock-on effect to it. Whereas, to be honest, it sounds like you actually delivered on the projects, even though you were burnt out when you're in education. But it's worth learning those lessons. And yeah. So I'd say to someone listening to this, if you're in education, and do take on the projects and calibrate, just be aware that you are doing that. I suppose that's the thing that you're kind of trying to convey.
Exactly.
Is that you don't necessarily realize that you're calibrating how much you can take on.
Yeah.
So if you are aware of that, take on as much as you can, but be conscious that you are calibrating what you can deliver at any one time.
I think that's a great shout. And use it as, when you go past your limits, there's a benefit there because now you know where that limit is. Whereas if you just were like, well, I don't want to push myself too much, if I don't want to push myself, there's like, you almost have to go too far in order to be able to adjust.
Mm-hmm.
So a question then on that, what would you say, so what does feeling burnt out feel like? How do you recover from that? You know, if you were to find another designer looking a little bit stressed and overworked, what's your experience of that and what can you sort of pass on?
I think what really helped a lot was Hugo, my head, of course, when, you know, I was becoming more and more visibly stressed with the amount of work that I was doing and trying to get everything delivered on time. And he said, just remember, we're designers, we're not surgeons. No one's going to die, you know? So don't feel so stressed. And I always remember that because when, you know, things that, you know, work later on in the years, things would get really stressful. You know, you've got like demands and deadlines coming and everything. It always helps just thinking that and just being like, no one's going to die. If this doesn't render in the next hour, you know, they can wait, you know, another 30 minutes.
Yeah.
It's not going to kill them. So I think to answer that was something that really helps me stay centered in just knowing that what you're doing isn't as critical as, you know, doing open heart surgery.
Then might feel. Yeah.
Yeah. And that I was working myself up too much because of that. But I think certainly feeling burnt out, you do start to recognize the signs, sometimes too late, unfortunately, with a lot of creative people. They push themselves to the point where you realize that you've gone too far and then you have to kind of take a break. And then the recovery time is longer because you've gone past that point.
And I'm going to butcher a great metaphor for this that I heard. I was like, nailed it. Was I'm sure we've all heard the story of the golden goose and it laying the eggs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the farmer has a golden goose, it lays golden eggs, and one day he's like, this is great, but I'm tired of waiting for these eggs to be laid. I'm just going to cut open the goose and I'm going to get all the eggs at once. And he does that and there are no eggs inside. And so now he has no eggs and no goose. And the way
I don't remember that part of the story.
Do you not? That's the where he that's the lesson he makes. Where
does not understand goose anatomy there.
Yeah. Doesn't understand golden goose anatomy. Yes. And I saw someone describe it as like, when working as a creative professional, it's like you are the golden goose and you can push yourself and push yourself and push yourself to try and produce more and do more impressive stuff, which is, but if you do that and then you break yourself, then there will be no more golden eggs.
Yes.
And so there's a tendency to be like, well, I can't exercise today or I've got to not get good sleep. And then it's gone. And it's like, if you do that too much, in the aim of, and I was going for walking back part of pharmacy, I was like, if you give everything to the job, you end up failing to give everything to the job because you can't sustain that. And then neither you nor the job has what it needs.
Yeah.
It's amazing because I feel like I've only just realized that lesson in recent years. Like it takes having worked in the industry for a while and then finding your breaking point to go, oh, as a human being, I have a breaking point.
Yeah.
Because you just go, work, passion, 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 passion. I'm wondering to myself, what do surgeons and paramedics say to themselves when it gets stressful? Because we hear it from other guests and people we talk to in the industry, the it's not life or death.
Yeah.
So what happens when it is life or death?
I don't know. I think you'd have to have a different podcast for that.
Well, basing this entirely on medical dramas I've watched.
Great anatomy.
Yeah, exactly. They hook up a lot in the on-call room.
They drink.
They drink lots of coffee and they're all ridiculously good looking. So
that's great. Right. Yeah, so you've made it into the industry, working at Trailer Place. You've designed, as I said in the opening, titled graphics for things like Peter Lou and Jojo Rabbit and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you there? What was your thinking about what you wanted to achieve either while you're there or beyond that? What's next steps for Santi?
So I was with Empire Design for 2 years, and I have a kind of way of looking at work, which I believe my father taught me, which is after 2 years of being in a position or a job, you reflect. You are either, have you learned everything you can't have learned from where you are now? If the answer is no, stay there for another 2 years. If the answer is yes, you feel like you have learned everything that you feel like you can learn, do you have room to move up? Or if not, move on. And going into the industry, I always wanted to do title sequences. So the work that I was doing for Empire was more marketing. So a lot of this, the films were already made. They already had like their identity. And this was more of like the marketing side of things rather than production and post-production. And it was a really good job. I learned loads, and it allowed me to have time after work to take on smaller projects. So like doing short films or animating and designing in my spare time, working with designers and directors that I wanted to be doing. And I did my first feature film, Perfect 10, which was screened in the London Film Festival 2019. And that was my first feature film that I had a credit on. And it was equally as amazing because it was in the London Film Festival. So it was incredible. So I knew that's what I wanted to do. So after 2 years of being at Empire, I reflected and I thought, no, now's a good time for me to leave because I want to be pursuing more production, post-production type work. So I handed in my notice in the beginning of March 2020 to pursue work in the film industry. And I had a lot of connections. I'd reached out to a lot of people. So there was a lot of work heading my way. So I started working with a studio that mainly focused on documentaries, but they did graphics for documentaries, title sequences. So it was a lot more in the direction that I wanted to be going in. But unfortunately, because of the pandemic, I worked with them in the studio for a week and then they sent us all home. So I had to work remotely with them for like the 3 months that I was working with them. And then everything pretty much shut down, like the entire film industry shut down. There was one project that I worked on with them, which was for Netflix. And I think I mentioned this earlier. It was a really interesting documentary because it was all found footage because they couldn't do any filming of or interviews or anything, which was American Family Murder Next Door about Sharon Watts. So I would say that documentary had like a very big emphasis on graphics.
Yeah.
So it was a huge project to deliver during lockdown remotely.
What's it like working on a film like that? Presumably you're working with material that isn't overly pleasant.
I think it's very interesting because from people that I've spoken to that have worked in that kind of work, you either become completely detached or you become really involved. And it is very difficult, especially as a young woman, watching live videos or YouTube Facebook videos that this woman had posted about her family and how much she loves her husband, who, you know, spoilers, kills her. And there was a moment when you were going through all this material, which you kind of have to kind of treat in a way that's not like over-centralized, but you want it to feel real and you want it to help tell the story as well. So there was times where I would be, you know, going through all this and I would be work. And then I would stop and then you would like hear what she says. And then I'd think, oh my God, like this is actually her. This was her life online, pretty much. Mm. And it's kind of hard not to kind of
to take that.
To yeah. So I think I probably took it the more emotional way rather than the detached, like, oh, it's just a job, you know, which I think some people might find that probably healthier or easier to do. But it was a dark, and I think also because of the pandemic as well, mentally, it was a very dark kind of time to be in as well.
It's something I've never really considered because I haven't had the pleasure of working in documentary at all, regardless of what the topic is.
Mm.
And I've never really thought about it. I don't know about you, Daniel, where we do everything we do is fiction. So even when there are deaths or murders or, you know, I watched a show called Gangs of London and there were a load of chopped up cows and human bodies and stuff, but I knew it was all fake. So I didn't, mm-hmm. I was just like, cool, this is interesting. It's a bit different from what I usually see and then move on. So that's really interesting. We'll have to get a documentary director in at some point.
Yeah.
I think we should, because I've worked on The Gold, which was a dramatic reenactment of the Brixmats robberies. And in that, one of the villains rather brutally kills a policeman, but he managed to get off the murder trial in real life. Rather unpleasant character. He ended up stabbing someone to death on the M25 hard shoulder because of road rage. But that was actors playing real events.
Mm.
So I was able to separate it in the same thing as if it was just a script that had. Though I will say there was one I worked on, The Son, which was by the director who had just won the Oscar for The Father with Anthony Hopkins. And spoilers, so cut away for the next 30 seconds if you want to watch the film. But the kid ends up taking his own life. And reading the script really affected me. Because there's a bit where his dad imagines an older version of him and you don't realize that he has actually killed himself.
Mm.
And that was a lot of members of my team really struggled with that. And the production did a great thing where they offered free therapy that you could redeem at any time
mm-hmm.
for every single member of the crew. And they made it very clear, like, you can step off set. And
that's amazing that they did that.
Yeah, and lots of people took them off on anyway, and it was hard on people.
I feel like from what I've been reading recently is that film industry productions are taking that more seriously now.
They are.
And the amount of sleep people get and mm-hmm. welfare generally has improved a lot since I started, you know, 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So after that rather harrowing
I will mention so I worked on that documentary and then obviously after the film industry kind of shut down for a little bit, I then started freelancing full time and began working for a studio called Momoko, and that was through freelancing, and that's where I got to design and animate the title sequence for Netflix's Inventing Anna, which was an incredible project. And then after that, I got a full-time job with Lip Sync Post, where I've recently left to go back to freelance, again, after the two-year mark.
Mm.
And basically, I would mention, because of the other documentary, that another documentary that I worked on very closely with, the director, Helena Cohen, she directed this very moving documentary about Grace Mullane, the British backpacker who was killed by her Tinder date in New Zealand. And what was quite fascinating about this documentary was the police were able to catch her killer through her social media. And you know, we had to work with a lot of material that was her, you know, her tweets, her personal blogs, her text messages, you know, to her friends and family, as well as her Instagram stories and posts leading up to her death. So it was very kind of interesting from a design perspective of how do you communicate this online social world on screen. So, you know, it was a very challenging but positive challenge to work in that kind of way.
So I have a couple of questions for you. Mm-hmm. From a practical sense, where did they source that social media? Was it still live that you went and got it, or did the producers provide it and it was already captured and for the documentary?
The director, producer and the editors would supply the material to us.
But was it archived and they got permission to use
Correct.
It? So it wasn't live on social media still, or was it?
Some of the pages were still live because I remember looking through at some of the, you know, her Facebook and stuff. And chillingly, I think one of his posts, because how they got led to her killer, spoilers, if you want to watch it as well, the murder of Grace Mullane on Sky documentaries, and is being released in America as well this month. They basically found him through his comments on her like profile page on Facebook.
And they're still there.
Or I think they've been removed now, but...
Probably because the documentary might redirect people there.
Yeah, but what was interesting about this documentary was the laws in New Zealand at the time. And I think they have these laws that the identity of the killer was protected under law. But because of what his acts were so heinous, the judge ruled this is an exception. Everyone needs to know his name. So that he lifted this case so that the journalist could then publish his name. And so that meant that this documentary could then ultimately be made.
So I have a question for going back to the sort of filmmaking side of things. Mm-hmm. And if other title designers are listening to this. So you worked on the one documentary 2020. Mm-hmm. Presumably this other one was, what, last year or the year before?
Yes, yeah, last
so
year.
So about a 2-3 year professional gap. Mm-hmm. How did you find yourself approaching this one with those 2-3 years of experience then compared to how you approached the first one? Both maybe from a technical perspective, but also maybe from a how do you manage
yourself.
Documentaries like that?
Simpler is better, basically. And I think, you know, every project, and this is what I love so much about the job that I do, is that every job is different. You know, the team that you work with, the material that you work with, the film, the subject, everything is different. And so the approach that we had with, you know, the Netflix documentary was very much, this is, you know, the Facebook was like her main way of communicating to everybody. So that was the material that we were working with. And so we had to create it to look as realistically as Facebook as possible without making it Facebook, essentially.
For copyright.
Yeah. Whereas the Grace Mullane documentary, our approach was, you know, through conversations with the director and everything, she mentioned how one of the pieces of evidence was that Grace's phone was never found. And it's like a vital piece of evidence because of all the data that was on it. You know, they were able to access, you know, through data requests, her social media, her location, through friends and family, all
without
that information.
Without finding the actual phone.
Without finding
That's
the phone.
Amazing and scary, but amazing.
But then there's still so much evidence and questions left unanswered that could be linked to that phone, which they never found. So the way we approached it was, you know, we imagined all the social media that we're seeing on screen is in a void because this phone is in the void somewhere. And we imagined what would it be like if that phone is actually still out there receiving text messages. You know, the messages that people are sending her, you know, friends and family that were concerned about her safety. They didn't know at the time that she had already passed, sending her birthday messages because she disappeared on her birthday. And they were texting and calling her and, you know, wishing her happy birthday. And, you know, we hope you're, you know, having a great time in New Zealand, you know, wishing you all the best on your travels. So from a creative perspective, we wanted to kind of approach it that way, to kind of show that in the graphics that these posts, the social media tied to Grace is kind of set in a void because it's linked to the phone that is like still out there somewhere.
That's amazing. It really shows the level of thought that goes into design. And it's why I know, like, I feel like people should watch all the title sequences and all of the graphics, because every element of film has so much thought behind it. But it's amazing, I guess, the narrative storytelling behind motion graphics and title design.
Yes.
That maybe not everyone appreciates.
Particularly because, so what's interesting is, and this might be an outside perspective that's completely wrong, you guys get to exist in a realm of imagination that, like, to contrast it with locations, like, it might be that the production needs to stay within the M25 or something. So I'm looking for locations that are geographically limited, or if we have multiple locations in one day, then it's again geography in that way. Whereas I'm imagining your constraints are only money and time.
Yes, pretty much.
And otherwise, it's your imagination could go.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's really, I can see why it's enjoyable.
You kind of, you know, think big, and then the, you know, constraints of, okay, time and budget.
Yeah.
You know, let's be realistic. Can you actually pull this off? Sometimes you can, and it's very stressful, but then you have an amazing, you know, piece of work at the end of it. At least you hope you do. But then, yeah, a lot of the time it comes down to, and creatively as well, you know, you might have an idea that you really, really love, and you think, you know, like, oh, this would be, you know, perfect. And the, you know, the it captures the whole film and everything, but then, you know, the producers hate it, or they have something in their kind of mind that they want to see.
That sort of brings me on to my next question. So practically speaking, how does a title designer get involved in a project, and what is that working process like?
So it varies. From my experience at Lip Sync, quite often, you know, we would get invited to pitch. So it could be for a film or a TV series that has either started production and they're, you know, starting to think about post-production and title sequences. So they invite multiple studios to pitch. And that's like a big part of the work that you do as a title designer, is you basically pitch for projects. So you get all your best ideas. You put together a really strong pitch deck with well-executed, you know, style frames or concepts with research to back up your ideas, and present that to the clients. And then wait and then see if maybe, you know, they liked your ideas or not. And then you could have a bit of conversation back and forth about budget and time and, you know, and everything. So that's one area. And then sometimes you're lucky, you can get a script of maybe like the first episode, or a very brief outline of like the synopsis of the film, which, you know, quite often, because of security reasons, they don't want to share anything. So you have very kind of limited information.
How do you tackle that as a designer, that you want to design something that's most, you know, relevant to what they're doing, but you only know what they're doing about 20%?
I think the other thing too is that because you don't know the music, you don't know the tone. So a lot of the time you can ask. And the, you know, production will send you through maybe like a lookbook or stuff that they work with. So it could be like a production will have like a lookbook, or like a...
be like sketches of costumes, photos of landscapes,
locations, yeah,
references to other projects. It's like a general, it kind of like what you get on Pinterest. Like, it kind of creates a vibe by just putting together a bunch of images. We are on Pinterest.
Yes.
If anyone wants to find us.
And it was a discussion point.
Pinterest is great as a designer.
It's amazing. That's really good advice, actually. Sometimes just ask. And it's amazing how it isn't obvious to everyone. I think that's something I went through when I started out in my career, is that I tended just to work in a vacuum. And then if no one had given me the info, and I was like, well, then there is no info. And actually, it is such a collaborative industry. And when you're working on a project, it's, you know, the famous phrase of it's an army getting together and making it. And actually just asking someone, whether you're on set, whether you're in the post-production phase, just, oh, so this is what I'm thinking. Would that work? How does this fit in?
Yeah.
What are you trying to do there? Those, just ask questions creatively as well as practically.
I mean, a lot of the time before we even have like a pitch that we do, we have those initial conversations with the director, producers, the team, or whoever we're working with. And we do ask those questions. A good example of the lookbook becoming a really vital part was the titles that we did for Winter King based on the books of the same title about King Arthur. And the lookbook that they sent us from production, you know, had like prop designs and things. And one of the things that they had was, you know, the design of the actual sword that King Arthur uses, Excalibur. And so we incorporated that into our titles, which then became really successful. And they ended up using those designs in all their marketing. So any of the trailers that you see for The Winter King, you'll see the graphics that we, you know, made for the actual show. And they've used those elements throughout the marketing because it ties in so well with the actual show. But we wouldn't have gotten that without having that lookbook that they sent us as part of the, you know, the initial stages.
Yeah, I think you're right on the money with the asking the questions in order to capture, because it feels like so much of film is realizing visions that you need to be able to understand what is being driven towards. And so for titles, you're designing those graphics to capture it. So it sounds so trite, but a picture is 1,000 words.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to tell a story in such a short amount of time as well.
Because
some title sequences are, you know, 10 seconds long now.
There's so much work goes into this 10 seconds.
Yes. Yeah.
Even more maybe than if you'd been given a minute.
I think one of my favorite examples of storytelling in a title sequence is the title sequence for the video game The Last of Us. Because at the very opening, you know, it's the very start of this apocalypse. And it's all chaotic and you don't really know what's happening. And there's a lot of drama and emotion. And then it cuts to the title sequence. And they use the title sequence as a bridging point to tell the story that they couldn't do in the actual game in that time, which is that it's basically a time jump. And within the title sequence, they communicate what's happening around the world and the virus itself, you know, with the spores growing. And they do that through the visual and audio, and that you see that spores growing and like multiplying, and then you get the audio of, you know, the news reports of, you know, what's happening, and then it gets less and less as obviously people become more and more underground by that point.
So until you'd said that, it's going to make me seem really stupid. I hadn't realized just how powerful a framing device the titles is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the only time, like, you couldn't do Star Wars where they do the title, the scroll partway through the movie, like once you start the film, you're committing to being in that world. But as you say, like with The Last of Us, they can give you that narrative with through those flashes, and it just, you're able to bring the audience to go, this is the type of story we are telling in this. And like in Game of Thrones, like if you didn't have that title sequence, and I'm basically telling a title designer why their job's amazing, but my excitement, like you. Because so much of that, there's so many pieces in Game of Thrones, so many different factions, and you've got to try and understand. It's like, I can't think of another way you could convey that geography in A, so powerfully, and B, in such a short period of time, if they were going to try and do it in anything but the titles. Mm. Can you guys think of, it feels like it stands alone in how impactful that is.
You do a montage, which it can be quite boring, so it's much nicer in a title sequence.
Yeah, and also I feel like it is a good device.
Yeah.
You know, you're not only doing the legal contractual part of the job, which is showing people's credits that you legally have to do, but you also tie it in with the storytelling aspect. And it's, you know, as biased as it sounds, I think it's the best form of storytelling. But I loved what you said, Daniel, about, you know, it's kind of capture, like it's its own kind of, sometimes really successful title sequences are like their own little stories, like standalone stories. And the whole idea of, you know, this goes back to Saul Bass, you know, with Vertigo and, or even the title sequence for Seven, you know, it, you're committed to this story. And the title sequence at the start of a film, for example, you know, opens the curtains and takes you into that world.
Yeah.
And sits you down and tells you this is what you're in for. You know, you go to the cinema to escape. So the title sequences for me is kind of like the doors opening into this world. And then, you know, you've got credits at the end, title sequences at the end of films, which, you know, I feel like, you know, you've just sat through a conversation with this story. At the end of a conversation, you just go, all right, bye. And then you leave.
Wait,
you
we're know? Not meant to do that.
Yeah. Imagine being in a cinema and then suddenly the lights, you know, just cuts off, lights on. All right, bye. It's yeah. not like that. And so title sequences and credits for me is a kind of a way of films and stories that you've kind of been investing your time with as a way of saying, you know, this is the end of the conversation.
It allows you to process it.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And sometimes it allows the film to answer questions that have been left unanswered.
Can you give an example?
Wall-E was a really good one.
The animated show.
Film. The Pixar film Wall-E.
Of course. I'm so stupid. It's Wall-E. I was literally thinking of it as Wall-E's in like, Where's What? No, like, Where's Wall-E? I was thinking, was like, they made a movie of the book, like, Where's Wall-E? I was like,
you're not a Wall-E, though,
are you? I feel like that would be like a horror film if it was being it was Wall-E. Oh my God.
Disney are like, making notes.
That was a very nice kind of example of that, where they have all these kind of like murals at the end of the film that are sweetly kind of animated, that kind of conveys what happens afterwards. So, you know, they go back to Earth, and then what? You know, they end the film with them arriving back at Earth. And so that sequence kind of just carries through the kind of closing credits of, you know, what's happening, you know, in that world that you're just leaving.
So on the veins of bringing the conversation to the end, we've taken so much of your time already. I would just like to end with one question, and then we'll see if Daniel's got one.
I do.
We always like to ask our guests, if you were looking for hiring a junior designer, someone coming into the industry, what traits do you think make a really good title designer? What would you be looking for when you hire?
Other than a mini me? No, I'd say the top traits that make a very good title designer is, you know, a good eye for design, number one. I find that a lot of motion graphics people, you know, that who specialize in motion graphics, not necessarily have skills when it comes to typography. And as a title designer, typography tells you so much. You know, the tone of the film, the style of the film, you know, like you can have a dramatic, serious, like historic drama is very different to a superhero kind of TV show set in the future. And that typography says so much. And so good typography skills, or at least eye for typography, and then eye for design as well. But then the other skills, I would say, are just soft skills. So working well with others, taking criticism well when it comes to your work, because, you know, you can have all the, you know, the amazing ideas, but if it's not what the client wants, you have to be able to change it. And I had a tutor at university that always said, you're a designer, not an artist. So you're designing, basically he explained it as you're creating a product as a designer. So this product has to work well, it has to do its function, and it has to be, not only does it have to look good, but it has to, you know, function in the way it's supposed to.
It has to be understood.
Yeah. And also as a designer as well, at the end of the day, it's not really your work. You know, you're being hired by a client to make that work, essentially. So, you know, if you take criticism well, that's a huge plus, because it means that, you know, it's very good to be passionate about the work that you do and take ownership of the work that you do. But then you also have to be able to
let it have its own life.
Yeah, in a way that you're just like, you know, you might nurture it and, you know, it's your baby. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to kind of detach yourself a little bit from the work.
So I suppose the flip side is, if you're a designer, not an artist could create for its own sake, but also it could just be their thing.
Yes. I think that's what my tutor was trying to communicate to us as students, as design students. You know, you can be creative, you can be artists, you know, but as a designer, you essentially have to do something that's functional. You know, you can make the most beautiful title sequence ever, but if all your credits are out of title safe, or they're not in the right order, or you know, there's like other issues with them, then you're like, well, we can't use this.
And title safe for non-designers means?
And so in film, depending on the broadcast, there is a space, I'm probably butchering how to like say this. There is a area that is viewable on screen at all time. And within that space, it's called title safe. And obviously over the years, that's kind of changed a little bit because of broadcasts.
Different formats.
You know, we went from standard HD to HD to 4K to now, you know, streaming online, where you don't really have title safe, but you still get, you know, you still have to basically apply it to everything so that you can screen it anywhere.
Yeah.
So those are like considerations that you have to have.
So for someone who's listening to this, who just loves film and not necessarily a designer, it's kind of like printing, that you would not put your word right on the edge of the frame, because some printers
will just get cut off.
Yeah. Or if you trim it down from A4 to A5, you suddenly lose a little bit. So if you design the whole document with everything in the A5, the A4 would, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
That's how I understand it. Danny, have you got any closing question?
It's two, I'm afraid. The first continues off what Tom just said about what are the qualities and traits. I'm curious, when people have done other jobs and then they come into title design, what are some of the jobs that you find most common for career switchers?
Oh, so from my work, I've, you know, worked with various different people in the motion design world who have come from different worlds, and I feel like a lot of it can cross over. So for example, one of my course mates, she came from an editing background. She had very little graphic design background, but she had very strong editing, and that was like, you know, she obviously brought that to her her skills.
It's its own form of storytelling.
Exactly. Editing. And as a title designer, if you're doing a, you know, a 2-minute title sequence, you know, editing, you have to self-edit, or even just graphics that you do in documentaries, you have to time it, you have to edit it. So I think that's a big part. And I definitely had very little editing experience when I first started. So I feel like that was an area of skills that I've developed over time, where she came into it already with that, like, you know, under her belt. And then she was learning the graphics side of things. You know, she had a much more artistic background from before. So she wasn't like going into the course with like no, you know, experience in the graphic world. But then, you know, I've worked with people who have switched careers, and they were like an engineer before or doing engineering, and then they, you know, they really enjoyed 3D animation, and then they got into motion graphics through that way.
And do you think with engineering, it's the eye for detail that translates?
Yeah, and the technical detail as well, definitely.
And there are many engineers who are very have an eye for design, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
It's just cause some people take different paths. You know, there are lots of very creative people in other roles. So mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
So if you're an engineer listening to this,
yeah,
maybe you should be a tattoo designer.
Give it a shot, yeah.
So there was a woman that I worked with recently who went into onlining, which is finishing. So coloring and onlining. And she'd basically been doing it for a couple of years. But before that, her career was an architect. And so when I was speaking to her, I said, oh, you probably find that there's a lot of crossover because you have to be very detailed and very technical when it comes to online finishing. And she was like, yeah, she's like, absolutely. You know, she finds that a lot of that skill that she had from doing architecture has kind of fed its way into her career now in the onlining world.
And the team working and the client management,
yeah,
and all those skills, for sure. Mm-hmm. What was your second question?
You'd mentioned one website that's used a lot. It was just seeing if there were any other resources, mm-hmm, that if someone was a junior and you were going to say, oh, you've got to check out these websites. Was just seeing if you had anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first website that is like the holy grail of title sequences is Art of the Title. And then
we will put it in the show notes.
Yes. Yeah. The description below. So Art of the Titles is the big one. And then you've also got, which I think is a little more underrated, is Art of the Concept Board.
Okay.
Or Art of the Concept Art. Again, we'll link that below. And that one is more to do with, you know, pitches. So work that you do is a pitch that you put, like, oh, it's Art of the Style Frame is what it's called. And it's concept art that is produced for style frames. So that one's an excellent resource to check out as well. And then you've got a couple of other websites, Forget the Film, Watch the Titles, which
yeah, lovely,
which is great. So they've got really interesting interviews, which I would highly recommend. And I think they released a DVD collection of those interviews. So definitely check out that website as well and their resource. So those are like the big three that I would throw out there.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight.
Honestly, if producing or podcasting doesn't work out, I feel like I want to be a title designer now. So exciting.
Yes, come join us. Yeah.
And so you are working as a freelancer.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll put your contact information in as well if people want to contact you or get a title sequence designed for their feature or project.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Santhi.
Thank you, Tom and Danyan.